Actually, we're going to be talking about preventing transmission of infectious disease in dental settings. Going to focus mostly on HIV. That's where a lot of the literature and the effort is. We're going to talk some about hepatitis and tuberculosis, and then on to touch on emerging infectious diseases and the considerations at the end of this. So here's some basic considerations for preventing the transmission of infectious disease. We got excellent sterilization and disinfection protocols at the clinic. No big surprise there. Carefully adhere to universal precautions. I know Dr. Appleton talked about this in his talk on Tuesday, about how things evolved from the stage of, one of our colleagues used to refer to as tooth carpentry, as the way dentistry was taught. And it's still practiced, I think, probably by many people. And we're evolving in the direction of a more medical approach to dentistry. I just graduated in 1983. I think in 84 was when the whole idea of we had to start gloving and wearing, because when I was in school, the only place we had to glove was oral surgery. The only place we had to wear eyewear protection. And I can still remember in probably 84 or 85 being at some meeting and some older dentist, seemed very old to me then, he's probably younger than I am now, he was sitting there, he was just adamant. They can't make me wear gloves. I will not wear them. And it was a tough transition for all of us that did it. You know, I did a fair amount of endo in my practice, and I don't have very big hands. And I know medium gloves work pretty well on me, but I could squeeze into smalls, and I could manipulate those little files with them stretched tight over my fingers. And after a year or two of doing that, I thought, you know, if HIV went away tomorrow, I would not go back. I like that protection. It's really important. And when we go on, we talk about rubber dam, and our trips to Nicaragua, we insist that the students use rubber dams wherever they can. We try to adhere as much as we can to the normal protocols, even in this fairly rural and remote settings that we go to. And here's a big one. You're in a dental clinic. Have the policies in place before there's an exposure. Discuss this with your staff, that immediately after an exposure is not the first time to be having a discussion with a staff member about what to do because they just stuck themselves with a bloody instrument. It's too emotional. You don't have a rational thought process in place going on there. And really experienced that situation I discussed on Tuesday with that young hygiene student sticking herself. Remember, she was rattled, she was trying to go too fast, she tried to do two-handed recapping with a needle, and she stuck it through her finger, and all it came out, exited about an inch away from it, and that was, she hadn't been through our class yet, we weren't there to discuss it with her, and you know, she burst into tears, and she's terribly emotional about it. You don't want to do that you don't want to have incidents happening before it's been thoroughly discussed and you got protocols in place. It's still going to be emotional, but it's more likely to be a rational thought process you go through. And this is something I always tell my students, don't work faster than you can safely handle. That's when clinical accidents start to occur. And in dentistry in the United States, you're in a managed care setting where you're just pushing patients through as fast as you can because you make less money per patient. The way managed care is set up, sometimes you make less money if you treat a patient than if you don't treat them. When you're in one of those capitation plans. I know it doesn't work that way in other countries, but if people get in that kind of a situation, it makes them want to work faster, unfortunately, to keep that profit margin up. And that's when clinical accidents happen. They injure the patient, they injure themselves, they injure a staff member. So let's talk a little bit about universal precautions. You haven't been back to Loma Linda lately, have you? That's Anderson Redlands Boulevard now. Okay. You know, we all know this stuff: gloves, gowns, masks, protective eyewear. You know, it's the routine stuff. Don't forget this important related activities: frequent hand washing. You know, because I work in this HIV program, I go to some conferences that a lot of dentists don't go to, like the Infectious Disease Society of America. It's a great conference. I try to go to it every couple of years or so. And I sat in this one session, and this fellow next to me was, he was an ID specialist from Case Western or something, one of the big universities in the East Coast. And we were talking about travel protocols, and they were talking mainly about food and drink. And I turned to him, I says, okay, what else is important? And he kind of smirked, and he goes, well, the next three most important things in order are wash your hands, and wash your hands. Kind of like the old joke about real estate, you know, the three most important things are location, location, and location. Okay. Well, don't forget that. If you don't have soap and water, we've got our alcohol-based disinfection materials. As we're going to talk about when we get to especially emerging infectious disease, it's getting more difficult out there. It's getting scarier out there. Correct sharps handling. We're always handling sharps. That's the thing about dentistry. It's primarily surgical. Now, what are we doing? We're dealing with sharps, things that we can cut ourselves with or cut our patients with. And aseptic techniques. Okay, now here's the risk factors for HIV transmission. Deep injury. And then we're talking not just dentistry here. We're talking about transmission in any healthcare setting. Deep injury. Visible blood on an instrument, patient with terminal AIDS, high viral load. Now, fortunately, we're not seeing them too often in a dental practice. Probably never. People like that are not going to be coming in for dental work. Device using an artery vein. Again, you don't see that in dental practices unless you're doing IV sedation. Most of us aren't going to be dealing with that. Diameter of the needle. Now, here's good news for dentists. No seroconversion to HIV has ever been observed, at least in the U.S., with a small gauge needle or with suture needles. Glove use. Studies have shown it reduces 50% of the volume of the blood on the external part of the device just by passing through a glove. You also lose some of it on your skin. And here's the thing, what about a second pair of gloves? There was a study done that indicated you only get about an 8% additional protection. In another study, and this is with nurses in a hospital setting, they found that it actually increased accidents due to clumsiness, loss of tactile sensation, and the nurses reported that putting on that second pair of gloves made them hypervigilant and actually more prone to accidents. So, whoops. The recommendations there are you're not getting enough. You actually may be making the situation worse by putting on the second pair of gloves. And I've tried it, and I don't like it. You feel like you're somebody in a spacesuit, or like I used to scuba dive. You know, and you got your big rubber glove on, and you have no tactile sensation left. The risk of transmission. Again, this is if there is any good news in the HIV field for dentists. Here it is. There are no reports of HIV seroconversion in dental professionals after percutaneous exposure in the U.S. I believe there are a few in the rest of the world, probably in places like in Africa where you have people with higher viral loads or in a more terminal situation and come in a dental setting. The relative risks of transmission per incidence of HIV and hepatitis. Take a look at this. It goes up by about a factor of 10 when you go from HIV. This is 0.3%. So per percutaneous exposure, it's about 3 chances in 1,000 with a percutaneous stick. Hepatitis C, it's about 2%. Hepatitis B, it's about 30%. Almost by a factor of 10 with each one. And mucosal splash on your eye primarily here, 0.09%, so 9 chances in 10,000 is what it's calculated to be. So the vast majority are from non-occupational exposures. And if you think about this, people aren't getting stuck that often in a healthcare setting. So you got it primarily from sexual activities, mainly due to frequency. You've got it from intravenous drug use because you got a large bolus of infectious material going directly into a blood vessel, and you get it from mother-to-child transmission from the massive exposure to blood in a
I would think in Africa, just tuberculosis would be quite high.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this. Yeah, and I'm going to get to that. That the percentage of people that are identified with TB that are also co-infected with HIV is really high. It's like 70% among adults and 60% in children. We're going to get to that, though. Okay, HIV from occupation exposures. This is a study that's a few years old, but these numbers were reasonably valid. I think probably still there's 57 documented cases in the U.S. of transmission in healthcare settings. 49 from high-level exposure to blood, 27 nurses, 5 doctors, MDs, and then various lab workers, medical students, maintenance workers, no dentists. NIOSH, I believe it's the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, they estimate, I mean, this is tiny compared to the number of exposures. They estimate that there are between 500,000 to 800,000 percutaneous exposures in U.S. hospitals every year. I'd have to add to this, there's an additional, I believe, 139 suspected cases where there was transmission to healthcare workers, but there were other risk factors, meaning they were probably in a sexual nature, you know, that was in their background. They were involved in high-risk behavior. But of these, again, only that number that they've actually documented that it came from a exposure in a work setting. Here's another study. Covered a 6-year period here in the mid-90s to 2001. And actually, effective antiretroviral therapy didn't even come in until 96 or 97. But 199 percutaneous injuries, and here's the breakdown on the various things. Most of them were with the small bore hollow syringe needles, burrs, suture needles, scalpels. These are more dangerous because you've got a little bit of blood inside the needle. The rest of them, it's all on the outside, so it's more likely to get wiped off. 13% of the patients were identified as HIV positive. No transmission was identified. Talk a little bit about HIV pathogenesis. The systemic infection is not immediate. You get a stick, you get some viral particles in there. The infection is not immediate. And this has been our tests that we typically do are that's seroconversion. It's the appearance of the HIV antibody in the blood. On the average, it takes about 22 days to appear. If you're testing HIV RNA, on the average, it takes about 12 days for that to appear. That's a much more sophisticated test. So typically, when they're looking for the presence of HIV, they're looking at antibody. PEP, or post-exposure prophylaxis, which is what we're going to talk about after this, can modify or prevent viral replication if it's done right away. So let's talk about the post-exposure prophylaxis and what to do and when. So the definition of PEP, the use of therapeutic agents to prevent infection following exposure to a pathogen. And the type of exposures that we're dealing with here, percutaneous, mucosal splat, mucosal and intact skin, which we don't worry about too much, bite, sexual transmission, IV drug abuse, and mother to child. Now, healthcare workers are primarily concerned with the percutaneous and the mucosal splash. For healthcare workers, you know, in the things we're talking about, the PEP is commonly considered for exposures to HIV and hepatitis B. Now, if you've had the Hep B vaccine and it's working, you don't need to be so concerned about hepatitis B. If you don't, we're going to touch on that briefly. But HIV is the one we're primarily going to talk about here, and there's a lot more information on that. So here's the potentially infectious bodily fluids. Got blood, visibly bloody fluids, semen and vaginal secretions, cerebral spinal fluid, gingival crevicular fluid, but not saliva, which is on the next slide, and breast milk. Those that do not require PEP. Non-bloody saliva. There are minute amounts of HIV RNA can be detected in saliva, but it's so small that it's considered to be non-infectious. Tears, sweat, urine and feces, non-bloody, vomitous. Now this was a huge concern back in the early days. What if it's transmitted by mosquitoes? What if a mosquito or a fly or something feeds on one person and goes to another? Can they transmit it? Fortunately, the HIV virus is not very hardy. It doesn't survive that transition. Otherwise, we'd have a far worse situation than we have. Also, you don't get it from, sharing food, from kissing. I get it's potential in kissing if there are sores in both people's mouths. In our HIV program, every week we have people from the clinic come in and sit and talk with the students. And one time we had this remarkable couple sit down and talk. She was positive, he wasn't. They'd been married for 10 years. They were probably in their 50s. And he married her knowing she was positive. He'd had a brother that had died of AIDS. And she was a nurse, I believe, and she admitted she'd been pretty wild in her younger days. And he married her knowing she was positive, and he said, we make love, we use protection. He says, I kiss her all the time. He said, I get tested every 6 months. It's been 10 years. It was just truly a remarkable story. Okay, here's our exposure protocol. Not too surprising. Start with a local wash. Soap and water. You got a splash, flush your eyes, mucous membranes with water or saline. Assessment of risk and counseling. This is where it gets important. This is why you want to have discussed this ahead of time. You know what you get, steps that you're going to do. If you're in an office, especially in the U.S., you have to make an exposure report, put it in the file. I think you probably do in other countries. Have your policies in place before the exposure occurs. Remember, I think I touched on this on Tuesday. The numbers here aren't so important. But the ratio, these are the people that are HIV infected, roughly a little over a million or so we estimate, around 300,000 or so don't know they're infected. So people can put on their health history and be being honest with you, saying that they don't believe they're infected, and they really are. We had an amazing incident happen in Nicaragua about 3 years ago. We're having a clinic up in the mountains, remote place. Dean Brewer, if you remember, graduated a few years ago. He comes back and leads this group. And we go up in the mountains, and there's no electricity. They stay in this ranch house, and they just do extractions for several days. And they had these Nicaraguan students along because we collaborate with the local dental schools. And they were doing these reasonably complete health histories on everybody. And they start to do this routine extraction on this woman, something like an upper bicuspid or something. It really wasn't any big deal. And she starts to convulse and grab her heart. And this just went on and on and on. Her family comes running in. They go, oh no, it's her heart again. They go, again? She didn't say anything about that. Says, oh yeah, she was afraid if she told the truth, you wouldn't treat her. Go, well, duh, yes. We probably wouldn't have if we'd realized she had a in this kind of a setting. She needed to be in a hospital. And she started to convulse. I thought, how does this go along? And later on, I went and looked it up, and you may verify this for me, Doug. I think it was probably neurocysticercosis, very common cause of convulsions, of seizure disorder in places where they raise a lot of pigs. And people become the intermediate host for the pig tapeworm. And if the cysts lodge in your brain, you can get a seizure disorder from it. Of course, you don't live very long with it. But they raise pigs throughout that whole area, and I've seen these rural places where the pigs are right next door to the house, and they're probably. People are ending up as tainiosolium? Is that the pig tapeworm? You end up as the intermediate host with the cyst instead of the end host with the tapeworm. Pretty serious disorder. She came out of it, but it was a very scary incident, as you can imagine, for everybody involved. Her most of all, but for our clinicians that were there and everybody else in the clinic. But she deliberately lied. You're going to, and in, especially in the early days when there's tremendous stigma with HIV, a lot of people, and people who were coming into our clinic tell us this. He says, I used to be afraid to say that I was HIV positive because I knew I was either going to get denied treatment, which has since been declared illegal, or I was going to get treated differently. And that was one of the things they really appreciate about our SAC clinic, is how well they're treated there. Okay, evaluation of the source patient. Review the health history. If they're HIV positive and they're honest on their health history, you need to know the details of the disease status. This is why it's good to have an idea of the, you know, what's involved with their CD4 count, their viral load. If they're taking medications, are they resistant to specific medications? If they've been found to be resistant to the medications that are commonly used for post-exposure prophylaxis, you don't want to be giving them those. And you need close communication with the treating physician when you're doing this. But that's what post-exposure prophylaxis is. You take those same antiretroviral meds that people are taking to control their disease. So in an unknown status, I'm going to talk about Oraquick in a minute. That's a rapid testing device. You can find out in 20 minutes whether somebody's positive or not, at least whether they've seroconverted or not. You can refer them to urgent care. They're probably going to do an EIA exam, enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, which is the test that's typically done. You can actually complete that, I understand, in a few hours if somebody sits down and does it, but usually it takes several days to get it back. So that's helpful, but not as helpful as knowing it right away. So like when we go on our mission trips, we take this thing. This window period considerations. Remember I said that it takes 21, 22 days for the antibody to appear, about 12 days for the RNA, but that's a much more sophisticated test. When our young lady in Nicaragua got stuck, they went to a hospital in Managua and they did an EIA on them and sat down and just did it. And in a few hours, she had the answer that the young man was negative. But this window period, there's a small chance that somebody is positive, but they're in that window period and they have not yet seroconverted. So it's not bulletproof. And if you have an unknown patient, how could you have an unknown patient? You know, stick with a bloody instrument. Any speculation on that? You got a pile full of instruments that came from several patients and somebody is cleaning them in your sterilization room. And they get stuck with it. And who was this scaler used on? Well, we saw 5 patients this morning. I don't know. So you can have an unknown patient. And the U.S. Public Health Service has some guidelines for that. Okay, other pertinent considerations, and these are really important. The type and the severity of exposure. You get a little scrape with an explorer or a little tiny stick that you just barely go through the glove and you get a little tiny show of blood. That's different than if you're extracting a tooth with a prior elevator, you know, those things that look like a little wing and they come down to a point and you slit your finger open. Or worse, put a hollow bore needle in like our young lady did. Okay, other things, age, gender, lifestyle, patient responses to questions, location, suburbia versus an inner city clinic. What would be your ideal stick if there was one? Probably a 90-year-old woman who lived alone and never been married and lived in a well-to-do neighborhood. Worst situation would be a homeless drug addict in an inner city clinic, at least in the United States. But here, no situation is risk-free. I used to teach the class in geriatrics at Loma Linda, and on a percentage basis, the elderly group is actually one of the highest growing groups in HIV in the U.S. There's various reasons behind that. They speculate that one of them is the common availability now of erectile dysfunction drugs. So people can stay sexually active as they get older. And people think, I can't get pregnant anymore. You know, why do we need protection? Why do we need to be careful? What can happen? Older people don't get AIDS. Unfortunately, they do. They can become HIV positive anyway. So no situation is risk-free if you're getting stuck from some patient. But taking post-PEP drugs should not be automatic because, as we touched on, they're highly toxic drugs. They have severe side effects. No dentists in the U.S. have gotten it, as far as we know. And all of these considerations need to come into play because the person themselves that gets stuck has to make the decision to take them or not, because there's fairly severe consequences of it. They're probably going to get deathly ill. But they won't get HIV, hopefully. So it's a trade-off. How bad is the situation? There's a number of rapid testing devices out. There's 6 of them that are on the market now for HIV rapid tests. This is the one that we favor at the moment because it's in 20 minutes. You can tell whether you the person's carrying the HIV antibody. It's CLIA-waived, which means they don't have to do it in a certified laboratory setting. You can do it right here. You have looks like a little swizzle stick, and I'm going to show you a picture of it, and you put it in and you stir it up, and in 20 minutes you can read it. It's actually a little portable EIA test. There's several other ones here that are the big advantage of this one is you can use oral fluid. You don't even have to do the stick anymore. When it first came out, it was like the little diabetic needle and you get a drop of blood, and that's what the way these other two are. But here it is. You can get your drop of blood, or you use this paddle. I got a picture of how you use it. Stores at room temperature, screens for HIV 1 and 2, results in 20 minutes. It's a little on the expensive side. It's about $10 a test. We actually take them with us when we go in the field. And here's how you do it. This is a slide straight out of the CDC website. You smear it along your attached gingiva above the teeth, upper and lower arch if you wish. And I don't know about gloves optional. Again, this is a CDC slide. But waste is not considered biohazardous. You're not picking up saliva. You're picking up like intracellular fluid or gingival crevicular fluid. They haven't actually specified that. But it's very accurate. Very high sensitivity and specificity. There are some reports of some false positives coming out in higher numbers than they liked, and it seems to be related to people pushing too hard. You don't have to push real hard with this thing. You just a gentle swab back and forth. And it's somewhere up in the 97-98% accuracy for both sensitivity to HIV and then specificity, so you're not getting false positives.
When you said about pushing too hard, are you saying that the patient may be HIV positive in the blood, but it hasn't got to the...
No. And this is just some reports of this. The operator pushing too hard on the paddle, thinking, okay, push harder, I'm going to get more stuff on it, so it's going to be a more accurate test. And they're thinking it might be distorting that little membrane or paddle or whatever is up there, just manually distorting it. So it seems to be allowing more false positives to be read. It's just a gentle swab. It seems too easy, actually. But it's been used for a number of years now, and it's considered pretty accurate.
But the other slide showed that there is very little virus in the saliva.
Yeah, so it's not saliva you're reading. It's they haven't actually specified what. And I asked this question once, and they didn't really answer it. I said, what are you testing? Is it intracellular fluid? Is it crevicular fluid? And the person didn't really answer it. So to tell the truth, I'm not sure what you're testing. Saliva has so little virus in it that it's considered to be non-infectious. But the test is very accurate, and it's been in place now for 4 or 5. Yeah, it's testing antibody, but I mean, what is actually picking up? What's the medium that it's picking up?
I think it has to be crevicular.
It'd have to, that's what I think. It'd have to be crevicular fluid.
Harder, you would get more intracellular.
Yeah. It has to be crevicular fluid. I think you're right about that. Okay, so here's the decision tree that you want to go through, and this is kind of a condensation of our Center for Disease Control recommendations. Patient that has a known HIV positive status with a low viral load titer, lower than 1,500 copies per milliliter, they recommend the basic two-drug regimen. Now, I put handouts with all of you here. This is a summary of this in graphic form with some algorithms, and this is a more expanded version of it. And these come from AIDS education training centers, which are very useful sources of information. And some of these materials, if I remember, I don't think they charge for these, and these are quite reasonable. This one's dated February 2006. Right now they're producing a 2009 update, but I called the person just before I came, and they didn't have them available yet. There are some changes, I understand, in 2009. But this basic thing is still here. The two-drug regimen, they're two reverse transcriptase inhibitors, so they're interrupting right at that stage where the viral RNA is being converted to DNA. And that's the sloppy part where there's... Do you have a question, Quinn? Okay. I started late. Two of the non-reverse transcriptase inhibitors, the high viral load, three-drug regimen, you add a protease inhibitor to that basic regimen. And this website would give you the current guidelines, what they're promoting for that. The HIV meds have been simplified so much. In the old days, people would take handfuls of pills several times a day, some of them with food, some without, some could be with milk products, some had to be, it was horrendous. And I hear people saying, I know it, after I took these, I'd be spending the next 2 hours in the bathroom with it, coming out of both ends. And people would get to the point where the disease can't be worse than the cure. So they go off the drugs, and then they get really sick, and then they go back on the drugs, and it was a nightmare situation. Now they've got it down. It's not wonderful by any means, but these two drugs, they're usually combination drugs. Combivir, you take it twice a day, or Truvada, the newer one, you take it once a day. That simplified the regimen tremendously. It's easier to adhere to it. Patients for an unknown HIV status, no post-exposure generally is warranted. However, if you're in a risky situation, consider the two-drug regimen. Unknown patient source. Generally, again, no post-exposure is warranted unless you're in a setting where it's likely to be, more likely to be exposed to an HIV-infected person. Timing and duration of PEP, which ARV, they recommend post-exposure meds in their recommended list is the first consideration. But modify it per drug availability. Say you're in a situation where you don't have those. Any drug is considered better than none if it's in an antiviral category and it looks like you really need to take it. But you need to pay attention to those resistant patterns. They're resistant to certain drugs. They've been documented with that. You don't want to give those. Begin within 2 hours of exposure is the best. It's not considered worthwhile to start later than 72 hours. So you do have some time. Reevaluate if you get additional information, especially if you've gone to a hospital and you're going to get your EIA test back in 3 or 4 days. If the patient comes back negative, you stop. If they're positive, then you continue, and the 4-week regimen is considered to be best. That was based on this. How did they decide 4 weeks of this was best? Obviously, they didn't test it on people. That would be incredibly unethical. So this is a study from about 10 years ago, I believe. They took 24 macaque monkeys and they inoculated them with simian immune deficiency virus and then treated them with post-exposure prophylaxis, and they administered it for 3, 10, and 28 days. And they found at the 3-day administration, 50% of the people had seroconverted still. At 10 days, 25% had seroconverted, and at 28 days, zero. That's still the standard. So it makes sense. And again, to our knowledge, and this is in medical settings as well as dental settings, no one who's gone through seroconversion has acquired the infection. Here's a little bit of information. The post-exposure prophylaxis registry in the U.S., 217 patients with a six-week follow-up. 46% of them completed the regimen. The reasons for those discontinuing, for that 54% that discontinued, 56% of them were due to side effects. If somebody's going to start taking this, you want to be prepared with antiemetics, anti-nausea, analgesics, because a whole host of things are going to start coming into play. Here's a new one that's just come out. This to me is very interesting. The multiplo rapid antibody test. You can test for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV all in one test. Get your results in 3 minutes. Whole blood, fairly complex, moderately complex procedure, so it's not CLIA waived in the U.S., meaning it has to be done in a laboratory setting. But you don't need a big, sophisticated laboratory for this either. Developed in Canada. Just before we came, I read that the CDC is evaluating it right now. What people are hoping is that with greater familiarity and refinements to this, it will become CLIA waived and you'll be able to do it in virtually any kind of settings. Here's some resources. They're on the handout, but this PEP line, this National Clinicians PEP line, you can, if you're a clinician, you want to have an exposure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are people manning this PEP line. They're actually up in San Francisco, connected with UC San Francisco. This is a very useful number to have. This number, HIV consultation services, anybody can call that. That's intended for also for people who have non-occupational exposures. They were just in a risky setting. They want to find out what their situation is. Because believe it or not, there is also post-exposure prophylaxis for non-occupational. Dennis, this is really a useful website, hivdent.org. Additional disease burden of HIV. We talked about this on Tuesday. Comorbid processes. Dennis must be aware of transmission possibilities, and this is particularly true with hepatitis and tuberculosis, which we can talk about very briefly here. But keep in mind the importance of the additional disease burden. The antiretroviral treatments are allowing patients to live longer with HIV. In fact, with some people are saying, how long are they going to live? 20 years? 25 years? We don't know. Comorbidity with other diseases is increasingly a cause of mortality. Replacing the classic opportunistic infections is the most common. I think we touched on this before, but in developed countries, people are dying now of hepatitis, cardiovascular diseases, cancers, liver, kidney, diabetes. All of these diseases are sped up, possibly by HIV, possibly by taking antiretrovirals, possibly by the incomplete reconstitution of their immune system, maybe a synergistic effect of all of those put together. In developing countries, you've got the burden of malaria, malnutrition, the tropical infectious diseases, and everywhere we're seeing a rise in tuberculosis. Hep B, believed to be 2 billion carriers, infections worldwide, 350 million chronic carriers. Lower prevalence in the U.S., it's about half of what it is, I believe, in the prevalence. But we got a vaccine available. If in the post-exposure prophylaxis, if you need it, is the vaccine itself plus hepatitis B immune globulin. Just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I read about this. There's a newly reported transmission of hepatitis B in a dental office. Anybody read about that? Did you read about that, Rob? Yeah. It was in an oral surgeon's office, and one patient who had no risk factors acquired hepatitis B, and I think they did some DNA testing, and they determined that somebody with that strain had been in this oral surgeon's office just before this other person had come in. So instruments, surfaces, something like that. Probably wasn't adequate aseptic technique or infection control protocols. Hep C, bigger problem in the U.S. than hepatitis B for chronic disease. It's now considered to be the most, I believe, the most common cause of cirrhosis and hepatocellular cancer in the U.S. These hepatitis B and hepatitis C develop over 20, 30, 40 years from the initial infection to the point where you start seeing these end-stage problems. I saw a report of talking about a lot of the increase in risky behavior that occurred in the 1960s and 70s. We're now seeing the fallout of that. People of age, and they're getting into these end-stage conditions here. It's bloodborne, big problem in the U.S. Truthfully, I'm more concerned about getting hepatitis C in a clinical setting than I am HIV. And here's something to be aware of. 30% of HIV-positive patients in the U.S. are co-infected with hepatitis C, and co-infection complicates the management of both diseases. It's highly infectious. Remember, 10 times, factor of 10 more than per exposure than HIV, and no post-exposure prophylaxis is available. TB and HIV, just a few thoughts here. Any patient with active TB should be tested for HIV, and the reverse. Any patient with HIV should be tested for TB. We've got a drug-resistant and extremely drug-resistant TB circulating the world now. That should be of high concern to all of us. And here's a terrible, tragic fact. In sub-Saharan Africa, 60% of the children and 70% of the adults with TB are co-infected with HIV, according to some recent statistics. Then end up with a few slides on emerging infectious diseases. The infectious diseases and the emerging infectious diseases, which you could define as new diseases on the market, like HIV and Ebola and SARS, the development of antibiotic-resistant forms, and the reemergence of old diseases that have been around a long time in new, highly virulent forms. Think about this. It's really a continuation of the ancient and ongoing struggle between men and microbes. That's really what we're seeing here. Microbes replicate and mutate rapidly. They expand into available ecologic niches just like all organisms do. They're just a lot quicker at it. Probably more efficient at it because of this, because of the rapid replication and mutation. Recent pathogen emergences are driven by socioeconomic and environmental factors. And you could there's a number of things that make sense. Deforestation, expansion of agriculture into areas where it wasn't before. I understand particularly rice farming is with people walking around in wet fields and explosion of rodents and vectors and things that allows are promoting this. Development of huge shanty towns with all the millions and even now billions of people are moving from rural areas into these cities that are proliferating. What is Mexico City? Has 30 million people now. And of the largest 10 cities, I think, in the world, I think 8 or 9 of them are in China. I mean, it's just a massive influx of people, and creates these shanty towns tend to create very dirty conditions. So this is an excellent article. It's in Nature, February 2008, by Jones. It was actually a fairly lengthy letter. And they analyzed infectious disease events, emerging infectious disease events, and they primarily by looking at the Journal of Infectious Disease over this time period, and they identified 335 emerging infectious disease events. That number shocked me over that time period. 60% of them were zoonoses, meaning they came from animals. Most of those, 75%, I think something like that, came from wildlife, not from domestic animals. So we're talking, again, HIV, SARS, Ebola, and many others that are out there. And the important factors seem to include increased contact between wildlife and humans, again, deforestation, spread of agriculture, and climate anomalies. One of the things they're worried about with global warming is malaria going to come back into the U.S.? How about dengue? Mosquitoes that are going to be able to live over a winter period. And this is that's just the U.S. So if global warming is real, and it looks like it is, I said, you can expect more of this. Findings and recommendations in that paper. This is one thing they pointed out. There's a latitudinal gradient in the richness of pathogens, I think were the words they used, with a greater richness of pathogens and other microorganisms the closer you get to the equator. Speculating is probably increased temperature and rainfall in those regions. Yet, the reported emerging infectious diseases was highest in temperate areas, in the wealthier countries, which they attributed, and probably reasonably so, to better surveillance and disease research. So they concluded that global surveillance is poorly allocated to areas where the emergence is least likely to occur initially. What they recommended was that we reallocate it to lower latitude disease hotspots, so you can identify these early case clusters before they spread, which makes a lot of sense. Let's stop it locally. Let's not let it become a pandemic and then we find it in the U.S. or Western Europe. Conclusions? Public health efforts are declining in the areas where they're most needed. That's an unfortunate fact. Reallocating resources would require unprecedented international cooperation. We can expect these emerging diseases are going to continue. They're probably going to increase if you look at the population pressures. It's supposed to be 9 billion people worldwide by 2050. Cost benefit, if they can do this, you should be able to sell this to the wealthier countries who need to go along with this. It's going to be less costly and better for everyone in the long run if they could do this, reallocate the surveillance and the research resources to the areas where these diseases are most likely to originate. And the reduction in human suffering, if they could do this, would be immense if it's a successful effort. So, last slide. Take-home message for Dennis and for everybody else. New EIDs are going to continue to occur. And it's driven by ecologic processes. We're talking about organisms here that are just expanding into niches and evolving. Global surveillance and intervention is critical. Public health expenditures are down, especially where they're most needed. And this new level of environmental cooperation is really needed to control existing pandemics and to prevent new ones. And I believe that's my last slide.